This is a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. Go to allthews.3cr.org.au.
God, could you imagine that music? I thought I was in a bloody lift. I can't believe it. 3CR's playing that. I assume it's AI generated. All right, let's get on with this. There's a few things happening, obviously. And I'm not talking about the festivities. Tonight, Frankston. Dinner at Frankston with yours truly and many, many other activists from south of the Yarra. Join us at La Porchetta's in Frankston. There's only one. Can't miss it. It's on the main highway. Starts at 6:30 p.m. Come and join the crew. It'll be the last one for 2025. We won't recommence till 2026. So join us this evening. That's Wednesday the 26th, 6:30 p.m. La Porchetta's for listeners of the Anarchist World This Week and any other 3CR program. Come and join us. Meet some like-minded people. Now, don't forget, and obviously I'll talk about this during the program, the Eureka Celebrations in Ballarat, organised by the Reclaim the Radical Spirit of the Eureka Rebellion Celebrations Group, which yours truly is the convener of, plus Ballarat and Western Regions Trades Hall, 4 a.m. to 10 p.m. 4 a.m. to 10 p.m. The first 2 hours, the dawn ceremony, will be broadcast live on 3CR. So if you can't make it to Ballarat for the 4 a.m. start, you can actually listen to the first 2 hours, and we'll be gathering at the corner of Eureka and Stall Street. I've got some bad news, but Peter Rice, who makes that brilliant coffee, is having second thoughts because he's got problems with his car, so let's not worry about that. Now, if you are going, we're going to announce the winners of the medal next week. Now, next week's Anarchist World This Week will be a Eureka program. It will be pre-recorded, as I'll be in Ballarat on that day. And at 10 a.m. I'll be at Baker Hill, obviously, giving out the Eureka Australia medals to six quite extraordinary activists. So that's on the 3rd. Now, don't forget, next year, the 20th of January, which I think is a Tuesday, is the Tunaminawe and Morbohina commemoration. Come and join us midday at the monument, which is just across from the old Ballarat prison. So it's all there. Not Ballarat prison, the old Melbourne jail. What am I talking about? So that's the 20th of January. And on the 18th of December, which is a Thursday, we're having a picnic, that's right, in the Parliamentary Gardens. They didn't invite us into Parliament House, unfortunately. The corner of Lonsdale Street and Spring Street, starting at midday. That's a Thursday. It's basically for the Talk Back with Attitude crew, which I'm part of, but obviously anybody who listens to 3CR who'd like to meet like-minded people is welcome to come join us for the end-of-year picnic on Thursday, the 18th of December. So that's lots of things coming up. Obviously, there are many other things happening in the city of Melbourne and regional Victoria, and I encourage you to get involved because it's one thing sitting at home and being an internet warrior. You'll get RSI of your forefinger liking this or liking that, but there's nothing better than meeting real people who are trying to change society. Here we go. We're about to blast off.
Evil minds that plot destruction. Sorcerer of death's construction. In the fields of bodies burning, as the war machine keeps turning. Death and hatred to mankind, poisoning their brainwashed minds.
Welcome to the Anarchist World This Week, broadcast across Australia on the National Community Radio Satellite. Listen the Anarchist Woolworths Week, Australia's sacred cow slaughterhouse. Listen to analysis of local, national, international events. Listen to analysis you'll never hear anywhere else.
Welcome to the Anarchist World This Week, broadcast across Australia, courtesy of the Community Radio Network. My name's Joseph Toscano. This program is coming to you from the studios of 3CR in Melbourne. The program is podcast. You can access the podcast by going to 3cr.org.au. And if you wonder what anarchy is all about, no, it's not what's happening in the world today. Anarchos. Without rulers, not without rules. What gives rulers the ability to determine the lives of billions of people? Inequalities in power and wealth. The anarchist struggle is the struggle to devolve power, possibly through direct democratic means, and the struggle to hold wealth in common. Very simple concepts. You don't need a PhD in philosophy to understand what anarchism is all about. Now, obviously, these are concepts which people have been struggling for thousands of years. Occasionally, things happen, and we do create conditions which allow an anarchist society to flourish. And other times, as in 2025, we find ourselves in a situation where authoritarianism and all its accompanying evils, surrounds us. Now, what I'd like to talk about maybe for the first half of the program, because I think it's important, because it's something that has been bothering me for some time, and it's the state of the nation. You like that? The state of the nation. I'm not talking about the economic state of the nation, the cultural state of the nation. I'm talking about something much more fundamental. Look, I've been a medical practitioner now for 50 years. It's a long time. And during that period, you see a lot of things. And I've been broadcasting, for about 48 years. You meet a lot of people. You see a lot of things. You gain a lot of experience, you make a lot of mistakes, and occasionally you get something right. But what concerns me is mental anxiety. Not in terms of individual mental anxiety, although we are a collection of individuals, but as something that defines us as a people. People say to me, well, what is it to be an Australian in 2025? And the thing that comes up over and over again is mental anxiety. Anxiety from the cradle to the grave. Now, obviously, in many societies, anxiety is a mechanism by which you cope with, difficult situations. But you need to remember that we're about 28 million people living on a continent, a resource-rich continent. And every day you hear something, you speak to friends, you see articles, television programs, YouTube, whatever you like, whatever you access. And anxiety seems to be a defining aspect of everyday existence in Australia in 2025. Now, obviously, there's always been issues regarding mental illness. And historically, we divide mental illness into two types, reactive and endogenous. And obviously, there's a little bit of intermix at the edges. Now, a reactive illness is something which you basically react to an unpleasant situation you find yourself in. Endogenous, there may be DNA proponent, and in many regards, it's like getting cancer or diabetes or blood pressure. It's part and parcel of the human experience, being human. So what I am seeing more and more is a reactive anxiety. And that anxiety is not related to individual deficiencies. Although the individual looks inwards and tries to find a personal solution to their anxiety, and we see this all around us with the flourishing of paramedical, medical models which supposedly teach the individual how to deal with anxiety. But the fact is that we are living in a very sick society. And when I talk about a sick society, I'm talking about institutional structures which exist, which are causing anxiety from the cradle to the grave. And I'm just going to go through this step by step. Because it's all very well to blame the individual or the individual's immediate family or immediate contacts with the problems they face and how they react to these problems. But something we don't do in Australian society is actually look at the wider factors which are increasing anxiety in a population which, in a significant proportion of that population, does not have major issues in terms of accessing to basic necessities. Now, obviously, and I'll talk about this, there is a section of the population whose reactive anxiety is directly related to their financial situation. But we are facing something which is more widespread. And I'm not talking about lack of faith. I'm not talking about some religious solution. What I want to look at is the structural issues which are creating so much negativity in Australian society and so much anxiety in so many people. In a period where you'd expect that as people's basic needs are met, that you wouldn't have these issues. Because when you look at the under 40s, one of the major causes of deaths in the under 40s in this country is suicide. When you look at the number of people that are receiving assistance through a medical model or another type of model for anxiety-related issues, we are seeing an increasing amount. Now, is this an increasing amount due to better diagnosis? Is it due to the medicalisation of human behaviour? Or is it due to something deeper? And my opinion is, although the medicalisation of human behaviour, putting it into a psychiatric model, and increasing methods of diagnosis have a place, that is not the major reason that we're seeing these huge increases in anxiety levels from the cradle to the grave. The first thing we need to understand is children are influenced by their parents, not in terms of ideology or religion, but they're influenced by the state their parents are in. And an increasing amount of anxiety amongst parents, increasing anxiety amongst children. It's simple. Simple. I mean, we live in nuclear households, not some type of collective environment. So you've got a number of individuals, differing ages, under the same roof. And obviously, the problems which their carers have are transmitted to children. So let's look at, so that's, you know, the younger population. Now, obviously, people talk about the net. They talk about the World Wide Web and the influence this is having. This is having some influence, but this is not the basic problem. The basic problem is insecurity. Not just insecurity due to the belief that you may be under potentially a physical attack, but an insecurity which goes much further, an insecurity which is based to a significant degree on the type of economic system which we as a society have created and continue to expand through legislation and through the bureaucracy, and the impact that a private investment for private profit mantra has on people living in this country. The first hurdle that most Australians face after they leave school or go to university is employment. In a society where those with the least are expected to pay the most for an education, what we are seeing is the creation of educational institutions which are more heavily reliant on private funding than government funding, putting pressure on students through the HECS scheme, which can last, you know, this pressure can last for decades, before they even get into employment. So the first thing we do is we saddle young people with a growing debt. And in order to finance that debt, many Australians, young Australians, find that they have to take on one job, two jobs, to finance their education, which has a profound impact on their future employment possibilities. Now, if you don't go to university, the issue is finding some type of trade. And we've seen the closure of the technical schools to a significant degree, although we've seen a slow reopening of technical education, which has basically meant that most young people who don't go to university, who don't find themselves saddled with a HECS debt, find themselves working in poorly paid part-time jobs. No job security. No job security. And with the introduction of the gig economy, we've seen that this job insecurity has increased. Now, if you do get a job, well, your next problem is, as I said, is security in that job. Do you have job security? And that with the introduction of individual contracts and the almost outlawing the trade union movement, what we see is this unequal struggle developing between an individual worker and an employer who may employ hundreds, if not thousands, of people. So you've got this continuing friction that people's income is not guaranteed, and despite various legislative initiatives through the Fair Work Commission, the fact is that in Australian society, if you lose your job, if you lose 6 weeks' pay, your whole life turns over. But it's not the fact that you're not working. It's the fact that there is so much insecurity in terms of maintaining that job. For example, I know situations wherein people have worked 8 or 9 years, they are fired because they need to be paid long service leave in the year 10, and the list goes on and on. So there's job insecurity. There's insecurity in terms of an increase in HEX debt. Now, the next hurdle is finding a roof over your head. Now, currently, about one third of Australians, mainly older Australians, own their own home. One third of Australians, mainly people in their middle ages, middle age, are paying off a mortgage, and the rest are renting. Now, obviously, there are many people renting who are not young, but the majority of people who find themselves in rental situations in 2025 are young people who can't intervene into the job market. Now, if you find yourself in a situation where you're spending 30, 40, 50% of your income trying to keep a roof over your head by paying rent or paying a mortgage, and we're looking at two-thirds of the population who find themselves in that situation, you've got the anxiety of knowing that you need to raise those funds in order to survive. Now, currently, it seems that everybody in this nation, except, you know, a few people, think that housing affordability is linked to increased supply. Now, obviously, there is a connection between affordability and supply, but that's not the main issue. The main issue is rapidly increasing housing prices to an extent where we have some of the highest residential housing prices on planet Earth. So how have we come to this situation? I've seen the debate this week saying that it's all due to first home buyer grants. The issue is that the Australian residential property market has been opened up to the world. Not just to investors, but investors from around the world. And what we are seeing is money pouring into the residential property market. Now, money pouring into the residential property market it doesn't increase productivity. But what it does, it dries up housing prices, which means that young people, either on a minuscule wage or saddled with a HEX debt, although they may have professional qualifications, find themselves in a situation, despite government assistance, that they're never going to be able to enter the private housing market. And the reason people want to own their own home in a capitalist society is it gives them a little bit of security. Security of tenure. If you rent in this country, you're lucky if you get a 12-month lease. At the end of 12-month lease, you may find that your rent has been bumped up to an extraordinary situation. There are very few protections in terms of rent rises in this country. So what we are seeing is an increasing concentration of Australian wealth in the residential property market, which means that people don't actually have enough without borrowing, and that's the key word, borrowing, to maintain a lifestyle. So today we're not talking about two people in a family unit working full time to pay the bills, but we are talking about two people taking on a second job in order not to live the life of, you know, luxury, but to pay everyday bills. So if you're faced in a situation where your wages are relatively fixed, where you are on an individual contract and really have no bargaining power with the employer, and you've got an increasing number of bills coming in, not because of, you know, discretionary spending, but spending to, you know, maintain a status quo, maintain the essentials, you begin to have increasing anxiety, not just on an individual level, but across the nation. Now, obviously, increasing financial anxiety causes problems within relationships. These problems are transferred to children. And at the same time, in order to get out of that situation, you begin to borrow. And the more you borrow, it's a little bit like having a drug or an alcohol problem, the more money you need to borrow to pay for essentials, or the more time, hours you need to put in to work to pay for the essentials, the less time you have for your family responsibilities. So obviously, and so obvious, we are seeing increasing levels of anxiety, not just amongst children, but amongst younger people and people in their middle ages. As you reach your middle age, you begin to think, is the superannuation fund I'm in, will there be enough superannuation to assist me in my older lifestyle? And the fact is that superannuation is nothing more than you paying for your own retirement. So we've got government legislation which has been put in place, which rewards investors, whether they buy shares, whether they buy real estate. But at the same time, it increases insecurity amongst older people because they become more dependent on the private sector to provide them with the essentials of life. Now, it's no accident, those of you who, you know, take notice of advertisements, irrespective whether it's the legacy media or the World Wide Web, can see a huge avalanche of advertisements regarding retirement living, retirement villages, cruises, you name it. Because individuals find themselves in a situation where they're totally reliant on the private sector to provide services for them. Even if you've got private health insurance, you will find that if you're admitted, that the bills will continue to come because most private health insurance companies don't even pay for most of the processes you need to go through. At the same time, if you have to rely on the public system, whether it's public education or public health, because of a lack of funding in the public system, we find ourselves in a situation where we're expected to put up with second-rate care because we don't have the private resources in order to pay for a particular service. So you get increasing anxiety amongst older people, one in terms of accommodation, two in terms of whether they've got a superannuation benefit, whether it's going to last, three, whether they've been ripped off by the private sector in terms of retirement villages or retirement living, access to healthcare, and the list goes on and on. So what you are seeing in Australian society, 21st century Australian society, what we are seeing is increasing levels of anxiety at every age level, which are interconnected to a significant degree with the type of economic system we have embraced and have accepted and have approved over the last 50 years, where we have believed it's only the private sector which can provide the basic necessities of life. So we find ourselves in a situation where the private sector demands for increasing profits come before our needs as human beings to live in a stable, secure environment. At the same time, we see governments passing legislation trying to regulate individual behaviour, not taking any account of the fact that a lot of negative individual behaviour we see in society is directly related to the fact that we live in an unequal society. Now, on top of that, we have the problem of the climate emergency. Now, some people think it's just a hoax. Good luck to them. But the climate emergency is real, and it's beginning to have an impact on an increasing number of people in this country as well as around the planet. Now, this type of anxiety, this what I would call existential anxiety related to the climate emergency, is an added issue that we need to face. Now, as things begin to break down, we see increasing levels of violence in our community. These levels of violence are real. You place 20 rats in an environment with limited supplies of food, you will see violence ensue as people as the rats try to survive. And in many regards, we're in a similar situation. So you've got all these increasing levels of anxiety. Anxiety regarding increasing crime, anxiety regarding the climate emergency, anxiety regarding housing, anxiety regarding hex debt. And to a significant degree, this is all linked to the type of economic system which you and I support. Now, I'm not saying by changing the economic system we're going to resolve every human problem. We're not. But we can decrease anxiety, mental anxiety, which is paralysing us as a nation today, which is dividing Australians, you know, on the basis of colour and race and gender, and the list goes on and on. And we're seeing this all around us as I speak. We see the hate merchants gathering momentum as they try to exploit the situation people find themselves in because of increasing anxiety. This is nothing new. Now, it's all very well for me to, you know, waffle on about the problem, but what are the solutions? Are there any solutions? Well, let's just look at housing to begin with, the housing crisis. Every day, people talk about the housing crisis. Now, just to remind you, you're listening to The Anarchist World This Week, broadcast across Australia via the Community Radio Network. This program is coming to you from the studios of 3CR in Melbourne. My name's Joseph Toscano. The program is podcast. Let's get back to the housing crisis. Every day you hear about the housing crisis. Every day you hear about people. Every day you hear about people having to deal with the housing crisis. And every day we hear about supply and demand. Every day we hear about private housing. But where is the debate about public housing, housing that is publicly owned and publicly managed? It's not there. Somehow, Australians think that if something is public, it's bad. Maybe it's bad because there isn't enough finance because of the way the taxation system is organised, the way our mineral resources are developed, the fact that never seems to be enough, you know, to go round. And we live on a continent with 28 million people, a resource-rich continent. So this isn't Bangladesh. It's not Sudan in the middle of a civil war. It's not Gaza. This is Australia, the land of so-called milk and honey. So we are not willing to look at solutions which involve intervention, whether at community level or the state level. We are not willing because parliamentary power has been usurped by a small group that own the means of production, distribution, exchange and communication to ensure their profits continue to soar, their wealth continues to soar at the expense of the bulk of the Australian people. Somehow we think that if we beg and beseech, we'll get a few more crumbs brushed off the corporate table in our direction to, you know, sate our increasing anxiety because of increasing insecurity at the personal and the community level. The fact is, as long as we don't see public intervention in terms of wealth redistribution, not just in terms of wealth creation, but in terms of wealth redistribution, we will continue to see increasing levels of anxiety in our community. And those increasing levels of anxiety lead to instability. They lead to authoritarianism. They lead to violence at a personal and community level. And around us, although the government of the day speaks the lingo, it doesn't walk the walk. We don't see legislative initiatives where the government of the day uses this country's resources for our benefit, not the benefit of a minuscule handful of corporations. So over and over again, we're told there's not enough money for this, there's not enough money for that. And the reality is there is enough money for this and there is enough money for that. That's everyday reality. But the fact is that we're willing for this to continue because we think that somehow things will change if we just sit back and wait and wait and wait and wait. So the increasing levels of anxiety in our community at both the individual and community level are basically due to increasing insecurity in our society at the individual and community level. And unless we are willing to demand change, radical change, whether it's parliamentary or extra-parliamentary is irrelevant, but radical change which ensures that the Commonwealth is used for the common good, not the good of particular corporations. For example, in the last few days, we hear about government's going to provide, you know, an aluminium company with, you know, a way out, or it's going to help this steel company. Corporate welfare has become the name of the game. But the fact is, you don't need corporate welfare. We don't need to bankroll corporate losses as a society. We could quite easily create publicly owned infrastructure which provides the basic necessities to people in this country. And that's why we formed public interest before corporate interests in 2015, a group that really has never got off the ground. Because most people think everything public is bad because it's grossly underfunded and mismanaged. So there are solutions, but those solutions are not trying to, you know, blame the other because their skin is black or their skin is pink or their skin is green. That's not the issue. The central issue which has created all this anxiety and insecurity in our society is directly related to the economic system we allow to flourish. And if it can't flourish on its own two feet, our governments, irrespective of what political colour they are more than happy to use public funds to bankroll private entities. We saw the ridiculous situation of aged care workers' wages rises because of government support for the aged care sector. Instead of providing public aged care facilities, everything has been privatised. And we continue to privatise various aspects of what's left of the public sector, including what we've seen with the CSIRO in the last few weeks. So, if you want to decrease anxiety at a personal level, and let's not forget, we are part of a community. Although we are isolated individuals, ultimately, how we survive, how we live, how we interact is directly dependent on the people around us. And if we continue on this pathway, we will see the type of solutions which came up in the 1920s and 30s where authoritarian regimes took over much of Western Europe, and we saw what that brought, the carnage that brought about. So think about it. If you're anxious, there is a political dimension to that anxiety, and unless that political and ideological dimension is addressed, nothing will change. You're listening to The Anarchist World this week, broadcast across Australia via the Community Radio Network. Let's move on. Let's move on. I mean, I could pontificate for the rest of the day, but ultimately it's up to you whether we move forward or not. All right. Isn't it interesting? There are good war criminals and bad war criminals. Now, I was a bit surprised yesterday. Occasionally listen to the Australian Broadcasting Corporation, the government girl at ABC, and they were talking about the fact that a number of superannuation funds were actually investing money in a corporation which was accessing illegal Russian oil. Right, and some of it made its way to Australia. And I said, oh, fair enough. But I've noticed that the heat's off Israel and the Israeli Prime Minister. Now, there are two major war criminals currently that we can talk about. We can talk about Mr. Putin in Russia, and we can talk about Mr. Netanyahu in Israel. They've both been designated as war criminals, and somehow they find themselves to The Hague. I think they'll spend the rest of their days in prison. Now, obviously, the Russian onslaught in Ukraine has had diabolical effects on Ukraine. But when you look at what's happened in Gaza in the past 2 years, every principle that we have espoused as a country, as far as foreign policy is concerned, has gone out the window. Now, I'm quite happy to listen to reports about this Russian oil coming to Australia illegally, but I would love to see the same amount of effort put into reporting that highlights which companies in Australia are benefiting from their involvement with the Israel, especially the Israeli Defence Forces. And there are many companies. Now, we hear the government put a lid on it, but more importantly, we don't see any real investigations. The fact is, what has been happening in Gaza, irrespective of the October 7, 2023, in any civilised society is totally inexcusable. And I'll go through the atrocities, which are continuing as I speak. We've had 70,000 people killed in an area half the size of Sydney or Melbourne. At least 30,000 of them are children, collateral damage. I'm not even talking about, you know, the tens of thousands that are injured. We've seen the Israeli Defence Forces target medical facilities, destroying almost every medical facility in Gaza. We've seen them target schools. We've seen the destruction of over 85% of every human structure available. We've seen the slaughter of over 1,000 people trying to access food. We've seen the denial of food as a weapon, the denial of medical supplies, the denial of basic covering, tents. And we continue ad nauseam to hear stories regarding the atrocities which continue in Gaza and currently which have reared up in Lebanon. So here we are talking about war criminals as if somehow they're acceptable. It seems that there are good war criminals and bad war criminals, and those good war criminals are those we support and bad war criminals are those we don't support. I know it sounds very simple and also very cynical, but the fact is that if Putin had done, is doing to Kiev, what Netanyahu did to Gaza, there'd be uproar. But we don't see that uproar. We don't see that uproar. So just something to think about. Now, something a bit more positive. Now, the 3rd of December marks Eureka Day. I think, let's see if I get the facts right. It's the 171st anniversary of the overrunning of the Eureka Stockade. People say, how boring, why bother? What's so important about the Eureka Rebellion? Obviously, it happened, it disappeared, and it's irrelevant. Well, obviously, there's a continuing legacy, and next week I'll be up in Ballarat with many other people celebrating the 171st anniversary and what the Eureka Rebellion means. And next week I'm doing a pre-recorded program on the continuing legacy of the Eureka Rebellion, which will be broadcast across Australia. It won't be broadcast in Melbourne because it's National Disability Day and they do other broadcasts, but it will be available as a podcast, and you can access that podcast by going to 3cr.org.au. So what's the essence? Why do we worry about a little rebellion where 50 people died? What's the whole point? Well, as far as Australian colonial history is concerned, the Eureka Rebellion was a defining moment, not just in the history of Victoria, but the history of Australia. And what we saw on the 3rd of December was an armed insurrection put down by the state. And that armed insurrection was about representation and access to land. And the extraordinary thing about the Eureka Rebellion was the fundamentals it was based on. And those fundamentals are encapsulated in the Eureka Oath, which was taken by about 500 miners at Bakery Hill in Ballarat on the 29th of November, 1854. And the Eureka Oath is a short number of words which encapsulates hope for the future. And I'll recite it now and we'll go through it step by step. We swear by the Southern Cross to stand truly by each other and fight to defend our rights and liberties. Now remember, this is 1854, not 2025, 171 years ago. And they spoke about we. The Eureka Rebellion is based on four pillars. It's based on direct democracy, direct action, internationalism, and solidarity. Ideas which are as relevant today as they were 171 years ago. What do I mean by direct democracy? Well, the Eureka miners and small business people use the mass meeting as their instrument of decision-making. They elected delegates with limited mandates which went to Melbourne to negotiate with the Hotham-led colonial government. So we saw direct democracy as the mechanism via which decisions were made, because the Eureka rebels, not just a... These were sophisticated people. Many were refugees from the failed 1848 revolutions which had swept Europe. Many were Irish nationalists who'd fought against the British colonialists. Many were Chartists from England who were sick and tired of having their demands rejected by the government. These were people, many of them, who had a radical pedigree. And they understood that ultimate authority doesn't rest in the hand of the state or the corporate sector or the business sector. The ultimate authority resides in the hands of the people. And they did this through a direct democratic structure. Now, the second pillar is direct democracy. What is more direct than people taking up arms to defend what they believe are their inalienable rights and liberties? And that's what we saw in 1854. People were sick and tired of being pushed around by a corrupt bureaucracy, authoritarian government, which had no interest in them apart from the collection of mining licences. And it's interesting to note that mining licences were introduced by the Victorian Legislative Council in order to ensure their poorly paid workers, the squatters' poorly paid workers, continue to work on the land and not go to the gold fields to try to find their fortunes. So in many regards, the rebellion was a reaction to that decision, which was made a few years earlier. Then we have solidarity. If there's one thing the trade union movement teaches people, and I did speak about individual contracts and increase in insecurity before, and the criminalisation of the trade union movement, if there's one thing it teaches us, is that all we've got is solidarity. If we don't work together, our chances of achieving anything are insignificant, minuscule. So solidarity was another pillar. And the fourth pillar, which a lot of people who wave the Eureka flag as some type of, you know, white supremacist flag have forgotten. The important thing is, this was an international rebellion. And although there are divisions in terms of religious affiliation, in terms of race, in terms of gender, the fact is, this was a worldwide revolution. Of the 13 people tried for high treason, John Joseph was a black freed slave from New York, and Mr. Campbell was a freed slave from Jamaica. Mr. Sorensen was a Jew, and the list goes on and on. And let's not forget that everybody who was tried for high treason was found not guilty by a jury of their peers. And eventually the Victorian colonial authorities under the British Empire understood there was no military solution to a potential uprising, and the only solution was a negotiated political solution where the demands of the Ballarat Reform League, the organisation behind the rebellion, were met. Now, if you are interested in celebrating the Eureka Rebellion, I'll go through a few details, because next week, I'll obviously be in the 3rd of December, I will be in Ballarat. Now, the program is organised by the Reclaim the Radical Spirit of the Eureka Rebellion Celebrations Group, which I'm a convener of, and Ballarat and Western Region Trades Hall. It's a combined commemoration celebration. We start at 4 a.m. at Eureka Park at the corner of Eureka and Stall Street in Ballarat. From 4 to 6 a.m, people from across the country will be given the opportunity to speak and tell us why they are there. And obviously, you're invited. If you can't make it, the dawn ceremony will be broadcast live on Community Radio 3CR. You can access that by going to 855 on your AM dial if you live in Victoria, or you can go to 3cr.org.au and listen to it live. After the dawn ceremony, there's a communal breakfast in Eureka Park. We encourage people to bring food and drinks to share. At 10 a.m, we'll meet at Bakery Hill, at the site the Eureka oath was taken on the 29th of November, to give out a number of Eureka Australia Day medals, 6, possibly 7, on the day. And I know 6 of the participants will be collecting the medals personally and telling us something about themselves. At 11:30 a.m, we'll meet at the old Ballarat Cemetery at the site of the common grave, where half the diggers who were slaughtered on that day, over 25, are buried in that gravesite. At 1 p.m, we'll meet at Ballarat Trades Hall at Camp Street for a light lunch and drinks, which are provided by Ballarat Trades Hall. And at 3 p.m, at the Eureka Centre, I'll be doing a presentation on the history of the Eureka flag. And that evening, we're having a small, we're having a dinner at the Queen's Head Hotel in East Ballarat. So if you want to come to the dinner, there's only a limited number of seats. It's essential you ring me 0439 395 489. 0439 395 489. So I can take your booking. Bookings are limited to 20, so please ring as soon as possible. Now, thank you once again for listening to The Anarchist World This Week on your local community radio station. As I said, next week I'll be doing a special Eureka presentation for The Anarchist World This Week. Unfortunately, it won't be heard in Melbourne because 3CR has a different program on that day for National Disability Day, but the program is podcast, and you can access that podcast by going to 3cr.org.au. But every other listener across Australia who listens to The Anarchist World This Week will be able to listen to that special Eureka program. Thank you once again for listening to The Anarchist World This Week on your local community station, courtesy of the Community Radio Network. This program has been streaming live on 3cr.org.au. The program is podcast. You can always leave a message on 0439 395 489. Ring now and book for the Eureka dinner. Thank you once again for listening to The Anarchist World This Week on your local community radio station.
Evil minds that plot destruction, sorcerer of death's construction.
An analysis you'll never hear anywhere else. Anarchist World This Week, Australia's sacred cow slaughterhouse. 10 a.m. every Wednesday. Listen to The Anarchist World This Week for an up-to-date analysis of local, national and international events.
Poisoning their brainwashed minds. Oh, Lord, yeah.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.